right. Good evening, everybody. Come on in and grab a seat. Come on in. We're going to start with our last piece of the afternoon evening. As advertised, we're going to do a time of panel discussion with these brothers. I'll introduce them in just a second. Before I do, I want to set up this time together. I'm sure many of you have gone to conferences before, and you've sat in on sessions where there are... You need to hear me? You can't hear me? Can you y'all crank me up there in the back? Check, check, one, two, no. All right. We're gonna have a time of panel discussion with these brothers. I'll introduce in just a moment. Before I do, setting this up, we've all gone to conferences where we've had plenary sessions, and then it feels like sometimes to fill time, we're going to have a time of panel discussion to hear from a few talking heads. We want this time to really be asking and answering questions that are on your heart and on your mind. And so we'll start off with a couple of questions we have prepared, but then we're going to have some runners that will have some microphones, and we'll go to the crowd, and you guys have questions during those moments. We want to make sure we ask and answer those. I want it to be a candid time of asking and answering questions. Again, to set this up, we've been talking about this opportunity for this time together for about the last 18 months or so. And the idea is, in the season that we're in, not only in the life of our denomination, but in the life of evangelicalism, we not only need to plant more churches to reach the lost of North America and the nations, but we need to plant the right kind of churches. And I feel like there's a growing tension that exists within our family of churches, amongst different entities perhaps, of how do we do this cooperative work together? How do we trust one another? How do we work with one another? And sometimes... a lot of the things that we hear are what we hear through conversations or on social media, online. And we've got an opportunity for you guys to ask questions that you might have about church planting and specifically about Send Network and where things are going in the days ahead. And so we have these brothers here. I want to introduce you to them. Starting down at the far end, we've got the Vice President of Student Development and Executive Director for the Center of Worldview and Culture at Southwest Baptist University, Dr. Jonathan Woodyard. Give it up for Dr. Jonathan Woodyard.
A big title, bro.
Big title. Yeah, he wanted me to add Kentucky fan, and I left that off. Sorry, Tony.
You just said it.
I just added it. Yeah. Author, speaker, all these things. Next is Sean Sears, the lead pastor of Grace Church in the Boston area and director of Send New England. Help me welcome Sean Sears. Are you also a doctor?
No, but I'll be signing his books after the
book
is sold out.
He is a former bat boy for the Minnesota Twins, though. What? How old were you?
I was 17.
17, so there you go.
Wow, I didn't know that. That's amazing.
The year they won the World Series, that was the only year they won the World Series, and the only year I was a bat boy, so 2+2.
Let's go. I love that. And then finally, we have the pastor for preaching and vision at Imago Dei in Raleigh and the vice president of planter development for Send Network, Dr. Tony Marita. Give it up for Dr. Tony Marita. You got a shout out earlier from Dr. Moeller. Yeah, we're going to try to send out some communication later to all the campus to let them know that you'll be here tomorrow. They can still catch you, so it's going to be a good time. Good time. Well, you guys are thinking through some questions you might have. I want to start off with a couple here. Tony, I want to start out with you. You are the vice president of planter development for Send Network. And I want everybody in the audience to understand what is Send Network looking for in a church planter? And how does the Send Network assessment help identify potential church planters to plant the right kind of churches?
So one of the first things that I did when I came into this role a little over 2 years ago was develop what we call the 9 essentials of a church planter. In many ways, these are very obvious things, but they weren't present at the time. So there was a hodgepodge of ideas, and there was a lot of picking, things up. Inconsistency, things here, things there. So the 9 essentials have really helped us. This includes things, and these are would be essentials that we're looking for in a potential church planter, but they're also characteristics that we're pursuing the rest of our lives, living out the rest of our lives. So we're looking at character, we're looking at calling, we're looking at theology, we're looking at your ecclesiology, preaching, leadership, prayer, You know, some of these, again, nine essentials that we think, when you're looking for a potential church planter, you're obviously looking for some kind of calling that's not just internal, I want to do this, but it's also externally confirmed by the elders of the church and mature leaders. But if a guy doesn't have the character and he argues that he has some internal calling, then we're going to question that. Theologically, we need to see, to get through an assessment that they can articulate the gospel, that they can articulate what it looks like to lay a foundation for a church polity, those kinds of things, to articulate basic orthodox beliefs, to be able to defend our own doctrinal statement. But at the same time, we don't expect those guys to be seasoned to the level of, teaching theology at Southern Seminary. So we want to keep resourcing these church planters, especially younger church planters who have a real zeal, a real passion. They want to go to hard places and do the hard thing of church planting. Their elders see that. So we just want to come alongside of the local church, as we believe churches plant churches, not networks, not boards, not seminaries, but churches plant churches. So my job is really just to come alongside and help and make sure that these guys have all the tools necessary so that they can thrive and flourish to plant what you already mention, a healthy church, a gospel-centered church, because we don't want to just multiply anything, all right? Cancer multiplies. You can multiply a lot of bad things. We want to multiply gospel churches, good churches. And so those are some of the things that I've been working on since coming into this role. And I think we've seen a lot of good fruit already. If you go to newchurches.com, you'll see a whole source of free resources. We just continue to put resources there. We just released a theology masterclass with 70 videos. Short videos on theological issues with professors and pastors from around the country. And so in many ways, we're trying to strengthen what has historically been understood by some to be a weakness in this network. And that is to deepen our theological acumen and to be church planters of substance. At the same time, not trying to slow down the process. There is a gospel urgency that we have. And so the two words we've been using is faithful and effective. We want to see faithful men who are faithful to their calling, faithful to the gospel, but effective. They get work done. They're passionate, and they know lost people, and they have practical skills that's required for church planting. And so we're working in both of those areas, the theological and the practical, to be faithful and effective.
It's really good. And so we have the one side, the biblical clarity, the depth of theology increasing. Sean, I want to start with you this next question. On the other side of this, though, while we have a desperate need to increase our theological acumen, there's also a gospel urgency, as Tony just mentioned. So what would you say, Sean, to a pastor or a Boyce SBTS student or seminary professor who might go weeks without sharing the gospel or praying for lost people or weeping for lost people?
I'm a pastor's kid who was raised in a Christian school, went to a Christian college, graduated, went to work on staff at a Christian church, then got a grad degree in a Christian university and went to go work at a Christian college. My whole life had been lived in a bubble, and it wasn't until we bought our house in Boston that I had actual close friends who were far from God. And I would say that I loved people who were far from God, lost people, in the same way that we would say that we love people of all the world that need the gospel, but I didn't actually have any skin in the game. I think the better question, not is whether or not you love lost people, but if you know lost people that would say that they feel loved by you, right? That's what my talk is on tomorrow, so I don't want to get too far ahead of myself, but I'm less interested, like if you're a student, I'm less interested in your GPA than I am how involved you were, one, in your local church, and two, in the community outside of the local church. If you don't have two or three close friends who are far from God, I don't think you're living like Jesus lived, because the constant criticism against him was that he smelled like lost people. And it does seem like the longer you're a Christian, the less likely you are to have friends, close friends, with people who don't share your Christian faith. And I think that that's odd. So we actually encourage our staff pastors to get a side hustle. And I will pay them one full day a week to not be in the office on the condition that they're doing some kind of side hustle. So we got a guy that opens up for LA Fitness every morning from 5 to 10. He is never in the office at 9. And I don't care. And now he did at the beginning because I couldn't afford to pay him. And when our church grew and we could afford to pay him, he said, "Do you want me to quit?" I said, "Why would I want you to walk away from the one thing where 50% of the people that show up for the first time recognize you from? That's crazy, dude." He said, "Well, now that you're paying me, do you want me to give the church all that paycheck?" And I said, "No, just give it to me." No, I'm just kidding. No, I said, "Use that for your vacation, dude. Like, I don't care, dude. Like, it's." Like Paul was a tent maker. Like when he would go into a tent, when he'd go into a town, if they had a synagogue, he'd start there. But if there's no synagogue, homeboy's making tents. Why? I need to know people here, and I need to put food on my table. So that, I mean, I think both of those have gospel intent.
And that's really, really good, Jonathan. Different subject, but kind of connected. Many pastors feel like they're just barely surviving. They're just trying to keep the ministry grind going, keeping their church alive, let alone multiplying. How do you help ministry leaders shift from survival to mission-mindedness?
Yeah, I don't know. I have a great answer to that. I think for me, what comes to mind when you talked about grinding, always being busy, ministry's tough, it's taxing. You've got 1,000 things coming at you all the time. I go back to when I first started planting. I actually had to go through an assessment with some guys from Treasure in Christ Together. Was a network that we were going to join. We were also planting through Ascend Network, and I sat down with those guys, and one of the things they told me in the meeting, my wife's sitting there, I'm sitting there, and the criticism, and this kind of hurt in the moment because your wife's sitting there kind of embarrassed, is like, "Hey, you don't know how to rest. And we're actually not going to let you plant a church until you learn to rest." And so for me, I thought, man, I'm mission-minded because I'm always busy. I'm always doing the thing. I'm always studying the Bible or writing a sermon or having coffee with somebody. And I just thought, man, I must be missional. I'm doing the right stuff. And really, I think for me, I was burning myself out and hurting my family more than anything else. So when I think about managing all the stuff and being mission-minded, I don't think it means be busy or doing the right things. Sometimes I think it means slowing down, taking care of your soul, making sure that you're resting in Jesus, that you're loving your wife and you're loving your kids. And that's not anti-mission, right? I hope nobody would say that's anti-mission. So you're slowing down. You're focusing on your relationship with Jesus. You're focusing on the relationship with your wife. You're focusing on pastoring, shepherding your own family. And that's part of the mission too. And then when that happened for me, I had to actually write a paper. They said, "You're going to have to write a paper to tell us how you're going to rest." And I was like, "Well, that sounds like a lot of fun." So I did that to write a paper to tell them how I was going to rest. But actually when I slowed down in ministry, then pastoring and getting my own church on mission became a little bit clearer to me. How do I help the mom or the dad who's also busy? I mean, I love how pastors always talk about, "I'm so busy, life is hard, it's always coming, I need to rest." Well, everybody's busy, everybody needs to rest. Life is busy for the guy who works at Best Buy. Life is busy for the mom who's trying to take care of her kids and work at the library at the local school. Everybody's busy. So it was for me, when I learned to rest and be with my Lord and be with my family, that meant I was in a better place to help other people be ordinary people doing ordinary things with gospel intentionality. So I think, I don't know if that answers your question the way you wanted, but for me, it was slowing down, resting in my own soul, and then the mission became a bit clearer for me.
That's really good. Really good. All right, I want to turn to the crowd now. If you got a question you'd love to have asked and answered, just pop your hand up in the air, and we got at least one runner, maybe another. It's going to bring that. Got two runners here, one on each side. Throw that hand up, and they'll come around and give you that mic, let you ask that question.
And ordinary people doing ordinary things, gospel intentionality. Footnote, Tony Marita said that, so I just didn't make that up on my own. I
appreciate that accreditation there.
I'm a little insecure. Everybody up here has written a book except for me. What am I doing with my life? That's how I
feel. Mine was just an ebook. I don't know that it counts.
I was a bad boy. That's it. I was a bad boy.
That's pretty cool. They said that first. I thought they said fat boy.
How you doing, gentlemen? My name is Bernard Jones from Dayton, Ohio. So just to give you a context of my question, we have men who sometimes get sent to go to seminary to get trained. I think you talked about deepening your theological convictions. And so I was one of them. Grew up in Dayton, Ohio. It was like a blue collar city, just grind, you know. And so when it comes to like being back deployed into these urban centers, it's not an easy transition. I was not familiar with Sin Network until I interacted with another pastor and what he was doing. And so I'm curious about Sin Network. Like, how are you cultivating emerging pastors or men who want to have a desire to go into distressed communities throughout America, and how we're cultivating them in such a way that we can actually have effective planters? So just being aware of... I'm sorry. So, yeah, I think that's one of them. But also being able to work amongst similar men who have been doing it well. And so I think I try to go on the website and try to figure out, okay, where's the data of current church planters who are in these urban core centers in distressed communities where there's unreached people groups? So I'm just curious about where we are and how we're cultivating those relationships.
Yeah, I'll start by answering that, and then I know a number of guys probably have stuff to add to it. So first and foremost, I think one of the challenges about being a family of churches like we are in the SBC, one of the great awesome pieces of it is the autonomy of the local church. But one of the challenges is the autonomy of the local church. So we have to choose to intentionally partner with one another so we don't have all these places of knowing what everybody else is doing everywhere. So it takes that relationship of guys saying, I want to partner with others in my area to be able to share what's even going on. But what we've seen over the last 15 years of this Send North America strategy that began after the Great Commission resurgence when Dr. Ezell came to NAM, this launching of, for about 10 years, had a focus almost primarily on urban centers. And what was happening there is a mostly non-urban denomination saying, we're going to focus on these urban areas to see work happen where it's not happening or where it needs to happen more. But I'm from St. Louis. It's where I planted. When I got into St. Louis, I parachuted in. There was already gospel work that was going on. It wasn't Southern Baptist, most of it. I had to learn and build those relationships. And then as we began to do that work, we had to raise up other workers, and we had to start residencies. So one of the big strategies is getting our churches that are in those urban centers building out residencies to train up guys. But one of the challenges is, where do you find the guys? And then how do you qualify those guys? I guess the third challenge would be, how do you help resource those guys with financial resources? Because we all know it takes time to train somebody. You pull them away from a job or whatever that might be. So those are challenges that we've been seeking to face over the last many years. But these last couple of years, our mobilization team has been working with churches all over North America first to identify who are our sending churches. And by that, they're taking true ownership. You know, because if you plant with Send Network, you plant with any organization, you have to have a sending church. But a lot of times it felt a little bit like money laundering, where a church is like, oh, I'll be your sending church, and they sign a piece of paper, but they maybe talk to that planter once a year. Check gets sent to them from the state convention, gets passed along. We want true sending churches. And then there's also multiplying churches, and these multiplying churches are those who have developed a residency where they're raising up church planting teams from within. These qualified men, their wives, and then a team of men and women and families who are joining them in that mission. So we're seeing a lot of momentum in that, but we need more multiplying churches. We need more churches that will say, we will take on this task of not just distressed areas, but anywhere where there's a high percentage of lost people. Because what I found, I don't know what it is in Dayton, but in St. Louis, we came into St. Louis and we said things like, oh, St. Louis, it's so dark and in need of the gospel because there's a lot of distressed areas. There are actually per capita more churches in East St. Louis, one of the most distressed areas in the country, than there are in the suburbs of St. Louis. There's little 50-person churches in every storefront. And for us to come in and say, hey, there's no churches here, they're like, whoa, whoa, whoa. We've been here longer than you've been alive. And what we had to learn was we had to get into that gospel flow and begin to partner with what already existed. So it's a hard road to hoe right now, but I would say the conversations like this question are saying, how do we help you do exactly what you're wanting to see because you have a passion for it, and that's going to pay off much quicker than us trying to produce it somewhere where it doesn't exist.
So I'm in Boston, and I wasn't raised Southern Baptist. I was raised in a different network. And it wasn't until our church was 5 years old when we started accelerating multiple churches out of our church that we partnered with the convention and NAM, because there's nobody who puts more money behind church planting than the convention through NAM and the Sin Network. So We looked around different groups. This was the group we joined. Our church is 55% black and 30% white and about 15% Brazilian. One of my biggest concerns about partnering with the Sin Network is that most of the Southern Baptist churches tend to be white suburban churches. But what I respect most is that they're very self-aware and recognize that, and to Noah's point, have been proactively looking to partner with black and brown ministers of the gospel that are under-resourced. And a lot of them, especially in the city, if they haven't had the resources to go to a seminary, are also under-trained. And there are groups within the Southern Baptist founded and even now facilitated and run by pastors from that context, like My Boulevard with
Dahati.
Dahati runs that. Our church is engaged with that. Also, there are scholarships available. So my executive pastor came up from within. Our location pastor of our largest is Haitian. That started off in the parking lot, just kept taking on more responsibilities, and now he's the pastor of our largest location. And New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary has scholarships available for a guy. So for me, I'm sorry, I don't want to offend anybody. I don't want to, but you know, it just happens. I don't think you ought to send your guys to a Louisville. I think you need to keep them in Dayton. And I think you just let them take some night classes and take on more responsibility in your local church. And then take a different side of the city than what you're already in and let them start a Bible study there with maybe two or three other families, couples from your church, as he's taking night classes. And then when you feel that he's ready to be ordained, I think you connect with your local send guy to have him. Once you feel he's ready to plant, that's when you... Guys have been sending their young leaders to assessment to see if they should plant. And that's, you're setting them up for failure, because then they get really discouraged because they're not ready. When you feel this guy's ready to plant, then send him to assessment. Then guys like Tony will sit down and say, hey, here's the four things you need to work on before you plant in the next 12 months. And then now that they know the guy and they've all had their hands on him, right? So they've seen him. They will help you find the funding and the resources for the guys. But I think the passion for the Sin Network is to not make the seminary the hero. It's your local church, and the seminary is a tool. But keep the guys in your toolbox, is what I would say.
You want to say something?
No, I want to ask you a question.
Who, me?
No, him.
Okay.
So I just want to make sure I understand you. Because what I heard you say, maybe not what you said, but... shouldn't send their people to seminary
in person
ever?
No, in person. No, I'm talking about, so like the context I'm in, the idea of these guys, they've got 2-3 kids, they got a mortgage, the idea that they would pick up their whole life and move to Louisville, Kentucky, or to wherever Southeastern is, or to New Orleans. Sorry, I wasn't raised here. Sorry.
It's okay.
And just so you know, I sent both of my sons are boys college graduates, so I'm a fan of what's happening here.
It's great. You're paying tuition. You're good.
Right. I'm paying Send employee tuition. So it's a little different.
No, that's
why do you think I joined Send Network?
You clarified.
Well, that's a joke. Enough.
Well, when you said it, I was like a little bit of a knee jerk, but when you said families, they have kids, there's a different context.
I think
the type of
the
person you're talking about.
Yeah. Right. But there's also night classes, there's online courses, because most of our seminaries are well resourced, but churches that are actually in the city don't know that. And if our father's generation all had to move out of the area in order to be theologically trained, it's good to know that our seminaries are becoming flexible enough to serve you. They're in Dayton, and they may not have to quit their job or sell. So our next two church planters, they're actually both signed up for the assessment in November. One is Keith Ford. He's black. He's the pastor of one of the largest high schools in the city. He's not quitting. I told him not. Like, that's what he makes, almost $200,000. Like, he makes a ton of money. Like, you're not going to be able to. You're going to hurt yourself if you do this. NAM is resourced enough. We can put a team around you to go do this. And so he's going to keep his job as a principal. The other guy's a white guy, and he's a vice president of a moving and storage company. And both of these guys are going to the SIND assessment. Both of these guys have been taking night classes in the seminaries, and they've never had to leave our church. One of them is a part-time. Keith Ford is the principal. He's also the part-time life groups director in our church. And then Jacob Hart, the moving and storage guy, he does all of our discipleship classes, like the talking head discipleship classes, like the basic, like essentials of Christianity type classes. But yes, but I'm just saying the seminaries are far more flexible now than they ever have been. That's all.
Another question?
It's difficult to be full-time working, and you have children to raise, and then be a full-time pastor. So it's just a follow-up. I think just like the transition, now that you are planning, you have been identified as faithful, but now it's about being effective, right? We talk about, you know, discipleship, and that's intentional, right? It takes a lot of hours of counseling. You know, you're talking about premarital or people with potential divorces, evangelizing. So how do you make the transition from that pastor being bivocational, where he can be fully unleashed, undistracted, into the body of Christ? Because you talk about also you got to develop your men, right? So I think from a healthy perspective, like how do you transition that guy now from working that full-time job, but also being full-time unleashed to the church?
You limit the scope of his responsibilities. I don't think the Apostle Paul was able to do everything when he was tent making that he was when he wasn't tent making, right? Like when it doesn't, anyway. So the team that we're putting together for Keith and for Jacob both, they'll be responsible for the weekends and first timer follow up. We're going to put so we can get vocationals full time, bivocationals part time until the church is big enough to pay your salary. Co-vocational is you never intend to ever give up your day job. Both of these guys are co-vocational. So Keith's responsibilities are going to be limited to the weekend and then first-timer follow-up. He's going to get somebody else whose responsibility is life groups and discipleship. He's getting another person who's going to be kids ministry. He's getting another person who's outreach and another person who's first impressions. So it's like if you put a team, like so it's six people. So it takes six families that are doing this, but when each person's scope, like as a church planter full-time, you are 100% responsible for everything. So if a sending church can be more generous in the number of people they send out with a guy, you can limit the scope of his responsibilities so that he's able to also take care of his job and his family. But if you make him do everything, he'll end up losing his family.
That's really, really good. I think one of the things I'm thankful for is a plurality of elders, is that when we planted, I wasn't the lone pastor of the church. So I was thankful, not everybody can do this, but I was thankful when I planted in 2016 that I took four guys, but there was more of us. There was a group that came out of one of the campuses of the church I was part of, and four guys were immediately installed as elders alongside of me. Now that, again, that doesn't happen everywhere, so that was a particular blessing. But very quickly, even if I hadn't had those four guys, I would have been trying to raise up and focused my attention. I can't disciple everybody at the same level, but focusing on men that I could raise up to be elders. Southern Baptists have known this from the beginning. The first president of the Southern Baptist Convention, W.B. Johnson, believed in a plurality of elders. So this isn't something Southern Baptists don't know. And we've been blessed to witness over the last 25, 30 years a resurgence of that type of ecclesiology. So I would say invest in some key men that you see have potential and raise up elders to come alongside of you.
That's good. Another question. Anybody have one?
Hi, so just listening, very, very helpful, listening to the plurality of elders, team of four, team of six. So when you think of the average SIND network church plant, is it typically four to six elders and their families plus others? Or so what's it look like? What's a description of that church plant?
Well, I mean, there's a great variety, first of all, because the church plant is really the local church's church plant, not the Sin Network church plant. So it's largely going to be influenced, obviously, by the local church. That would be my preference, is that you have a team of either elders or elder candidates plus a lead individual and a team of church planting missionaries, if you will. I think that is the healthiest model. We see all sorts of models, and we see them in all different contexts. I mean, if you came to a Send Network orientation, you would see diversity that would make you say, is this the Southern Baptist Convention? It's really remarkable, you know. So we have an assessment in Arabic. We have the nine essentials translated into a dozen languages, right? So and this is why we need training, because a lot of the guys coming through SEND assessment are not coming from robustly theological churches. And so we are trying to get upstream and to help resource them. So I think there's going to be a great variation. I think our preference would be you're not a Lone Ranger.
Right.
You're not parachuting into a city. For me personally, it was me and two other elders and a team. That's my personal preference. If those elders can be bivocational or at least have a side hustle so that they don't feel the pressure of making it in 3 years and then funding drops and they're toast, that's the best way. If you can remove the numbers pressure and the money pressure, the numbers of people, right? That's usually the two pressures church planters feel. I've got to get to 100 people or I won't be self-sustaining, and I've got to get there in 3 to 5 years or the money will run out. But if you have team bivocational church planters or co-vocational, you don't have that financial pressure nor the numerical pressure, and now you can start really thinking about health and quality and depth and allow the Lord to grow the church. That would be my sort of personal counseling. But again, because we're serving local churches, we see all sorts of kind of approaches that are trying to be exercised.
When you say
the
lower the number of people, probably the longer runway. The smaller number of people that go, the longer the runway. It's like if a guy does get parachuted, it's just going to take him longer to get that thing up and going.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not ideal, but it's happened.
You know, one of the initiatives we've talked about over the last couple of years, beyond the nine essentials and focusing on seeing that become more robust and expanded for our church planter and the church planting couple to assess their readiness to plant, is the development of the church planting team concept. So much of what we've seen, and Vance Pittman talks about this a lot, it's one of his great burdens, what we see in the methodology of church planting is upside down missiologically according to Scripture. We send a church planter out, he rents a storefront, he gets his mailer, he starts a church service, and through that church service, he hopes to then make some disciples, and through those disciples, then turn around and engage the city with the gospel. But when you read the book of Acts, it's missiologically the other way around, that a group of people go in and they engage the city with the gospel. As they engage that city, they make disciples, and out of those disciples, Jesus plants his church. And so as we train people in that, we're realizing goes hand in glove with this is the development of church planting, the training of church planting teams, which we say by definition are a group of diversely gifted men, women, and families who are sent in with a church planter to engage the city with the gospel, make disciples, and plant the church. And when you focus on it that way, all of a sudden, if it is even a parachute or it's across town, you have a group of people who are saying, we're all church planting missionaries. We have a lead pastor that leads that, and we will eventually have a plurality of elders, but we all have a role to play, and we're not trying to get a church service started. We're trying to engage the city and make disciples. Now, it feels like, in that way, a longer runway or a slower road, but what we've done for so many years, and at least the last 20 in this church planting movement we've seen of all different denominations, is about the service. It's the man and the service. Let's find a guy, and let's start a church service. And what that doesn't do is model the book of Acts. And we want to shift that. We want to see that grow and expand a bit. Anything you brothers would add?
We talk about it in Boston that the guys who come up to Boston to start a church don't make it. But the guys who come up to Boston and pick a community that they're going to live in for the rest of their life and die there, whether they get a church started or not, those are the guys whose churches actually make it. Like it's the more, it's a greater commitment to reaching the community. Like that's the mentality than it is actually starting a church. And those guys end up with a church that makes it. So that intention when they get there, it's crazy. Like me and Aaron Cavan talk about it all the time. It's like, if you talk to this guy, like all he talks about is church. Like, I don't even think he knows anybody in this town. I don't think this is going to work. And we don't like, you know, shun the guy. We just cut him off until he dries up on the vine. And then I'm just kidding. We surround the guy. We coach him up is what we do. And we try to free up his time so he's got more margin to get involved in the community. But it's the idea that I'm going to pick a town. Don't start a church. Pick a town to reach. And then a church comes up. It's 100% true.
One of the things about church planting that has been historically measured and studied and spoken about is a church planting survivability rate. And so one of the things I want to talk about, we can argue about the statistics and what the rate is and those kinds of things, but I would love to hear from each of you. So maybe think of two or three top answers in case one of the other guys steals yours. But what are some of the top reasons you've seen that church plants don't make it? We don't like to use the big F word, fail. Right? Not that big F word. You're from
Why
Boston.
Why are you looking at me? Yeah. Him, not me.
We just made the face. We don't want to say fail. God sends somebody in that faithfulness might look like, hey, this is a stint. This is a ministry stint, and God has plans around that. But why would you say are some of the top reasons that church plants fail? We want to answer this in a way that helps people to prepare so that they don't. So what are some of those reasons you guys would speak to?
Lack of prayer. If I had to do over again, we would pray a lot more as a core team. I think it has become just a supplemental thing we do in the church when it is an essential thing we do in the church. It's often perfunctory. It's very minimal. So that's one thing. I just see a lack of desperation that somehow we think we can market our way to a church, right? Lack of gospel proclamation, either in evangelism or in preaching. And so what you've made are really not converts. You've made maybe some fans or whatever. So I think there's a real gospel issue. I think sometimes on the flip side, you have guys who are theologically robust. They're not good with people. And I think if you are going to plant a church, people need to at least want to be around you, you know? And I think we have a whole lot of guys that they just can't gather people. Yeah. Nobody wants to be with them, and that's a problem. It's not just a relational personality problem. There's several problems with that. But I've seen that. Guys who can argue really well doctrine, but they're not leaders. They're not leaders of people. And so there are certain people skills that are not, you know, remedial, they're not of marginal importance. Like those people skills, this is what we are in the people work. Mm. And so the trellis and the vine, right? If you're not tending to the vine well, to people well, there's a problem. So I see that. I see lack of prayer. I see lack of gospel. Marriage is a massive one. We continue. You guys want to answer?
All the good ones.
That was a really good one. Money, but it's
fine. I've been here all day and finally getting to talk. So. I'm on a roll, man.
Keep going.
Good, man.
I've got dinner at 7.
Go.
Okay. It's sad, but we see failing marriages a lot, even among some of our better church planters that are seasoned now. That's just huge. When marriages are not strong, when the wife's not on board, or just it's not healthy, that's a big one. Sometimes guys are overly ambitious, or they're just not wise. They go into the wrong place. They don't think practically sometimes. Should the guy from deep South Alabama go to Manhattan? I'm not going to say he should never do it, but man, I would really be asking some questions. And so sometimes I think there is a context issue where it doesn't work. Sometimes the Lord just wants us to fail. I think if you are being faithful and faithful to the gospel, and again, faithful to your wife, faithful to your calling, it's okay to fail. Like, I think I want to actually tell guys who are perfectionists, who have a fear of failure, Like, you need to watch baseball. Mm-hmm. 3 out of 10 for 15 years, you're in the Hall of Fame. So you're going to fail. It's a sport of failure, which is why it's a great sport. But I think some guys are too paralyzed. And some guys just are not asking hard enough questions before they go in. Sometimes it's a lack of maturity. It's moving way too quick, which is why the local church is, again, so important here. We have to vet our church planters. And we can't be numbers hungry. We can't be so zealous that we're not wise. And we need to send the guy at the right time with the right team in the right place with a lot of prayer, you know. Those are some of the things that come to mind.
John?
When I was getting ready to plant in Northfield, I was sitting with Pastor John, and he said, "In mid-bite of a sandwich, it won't work. You have a southern accent." It worked, but I thought it was funny. You saw the guy from Alabama.
You were talking to who, Pastor who?
John.
John who?
Piper. Okay. He calls him John. That's how close they are.
So even John Piper can get it wrong every once in a while.
Yeah, every now and then.
Yeah. What else you get? What would you say, Sean? What are some reasons that church plants fail?
At year four, my wife called me on her way back from her sister's house to tell me she was taking the kids and moving to Florida. So I would say the number one thing is if your wife is unhappy. In the garden, the curse was your tails in the field and her desires for the relationship. So I think that the sin default in men, generally speaking, is that our relationships can be unhealthy, but if we feel like we're successful at work, we're okay. And I feel like it's the exact opposite with our wives. They don't care how it's going at work. If their relationships are healthy, they feel like they're okay. So it took us 4 years to get to 100. So, and everybody's like, "How big's your church? How big's your church? How big's your church? Well, you should call this guy. He started the same time you did. He's 3 times bigger than you." And it just, you just feel like you stink at everything. And if this is the one thing that I was sure God wanted me to do, and I stink at this, then what the heck? I don't even know who I am now, right? So then you just pour more into it, and more into it, more into it. And I have my wife's permission to talk about this. And when we coach couples, we talk about this. And she said, I just got tired of being a married mom who was living like a single mother. And there's only so long your wife can feel like she's alone. So I think the number one thing is loneliness for our wives. Like, we're out meeting people all the time, especially if you have small kids and they're at home all the time. Like, they have no friend, like they have no context, and especially if it's a new community that you're not from. So in Boston, like John Chastain and I, we could probably come up with 10 people right now. I can tell you 4 people just in the last 3 years that have quit because their wives got homesick. So if you're from a long way away, I would say put in your church's year one budget for your wife to fly home to her parents' house 3 times that year. Bruce Miller talks about boundaries, and he says, bookend seasons of stress with punctuated rest. So if you know you're going to go into a season of chaos, before it starts, you go do something awesome with your wife or send your wife to go visit her family and then come back, and for the next 2 months, it's going to be crazy. But you already put the date on the calendar where she gets to go home. You need to put a light at the end of the tunnel, because if you don't tell her where the light is at the end of the tunnel, she feels like it's going to be this dark forever. There's only so long your wife can hang on when she's always unhappy.
I would say just one thing.
By the way, she didn't actually leave me. I needed to finish that story.
That was gonna be my question. Yeah. Like, no, but I would think, and I know you guys can correct this, but it's more just as we talk about things, why things don't work. Sometimes it's not that you did anything wrong.
Yeah.
And you were faithful, and you loved your wife, and you loved your family, and you loved your kids, and you knew lost people in your city, and the Lord just didn't do it. He's like, this. And it's not wrong.
Yeah.
And you can rest easy at night. So I wouldn't want anybody to hear or say, man, if it doesn't work, then something they said up there, I screwed something up. That's not necessarily the case. So go and be faithful. And if the Lord blesses it,
sing his praises and if he doesn't sing his praises.
That's good, man. That is good.
That's really good. We found when I was in St. Louis, I was a Send City missionary in St. Louis for a decade before I took a larger, broader role. And we noticed a few years into that role that there were a lot of guys that were planting that weren't making it or they're struggling at like the 2 to 3 year mark. And we did a little bit of study and conversation. We realized, talking to all our catalysts in a couple of states, that the number one predictor of their ability to make it past that time frame was their communication. And here's what I mean. A lot of guys get assessed on preaching. Can a guy preach a sermon? Now, we have made that more robust. It used to be a 6-minute sermonette, which was not great at all. Anybody can fake it to make it through that. Or somebody's been a youth pastor. They preach all their youth pastor messages for the first year. And they're like, hey, this guy's good. Weekly exposition is hard. And it takes a lot of effort. But beyond that, church planting is not just about preaching sermons. And so I wrapped it in. Well, I started a preaching lab in my church. And then we expanded it not only to church planters within a couple states, but to local church pastors that said, do you want to raise up guys or you yourself want to come? And we had over 200 guys in the course of about 500 years go through this. Shameless plug, I based it on Tony Morita's book, Faithful Preaching. That whole process that you have in that book, which is so good, Christ-centered expositor now. But what we did in this, we said it comes down to three things. The same gift that you need in every level of church planting is the ability to cast a compelling vision. You have to be able to cast a vision to lost people to come and hear the gospel. You have to cast a compelling vision to raise a core team, to get people to want to actually go with you. You have to cast a compelling vision to show them the scriptures and not just tell them what it says, but why they should love it and obey it, on and on. So we train people not just to preach a sermon, but the ability to cast a compelling vision in different levels. As we saw that, the level raised, because guys could do that for much longer than they could with this treasure trove of sermons they brought with them. So I would just tell a young guy who's training in planting, learn to do more than just preach. Like one of the drills we would do in our preaching lab is I'd always start the first week with gospel fluency. I'd grab a box and get this junk in my office, throw it in the box, throw it out on the floor. We'd have 10, 15, 20 guys. And starting with the newest Christian, if you're the oldest Christian, you had to wait. Now, you've been saved for 25 years. You should be better at this. Take an object from that pile and in 30 seconds, get to the gospel. A paperclip, relate that to Jesus, you know, whatever that's it might awesome. Be. And they had to learn how to cast a compelling vision to maybe 30 seconds to a lost person or 30 minutes to a saved person, whatever it might be. So for us, it was that casting a compelling vision, help guys grow. We have a few more questions I have planned to prepare, but I want to make sure we get all the things that might be on your heads and your hearts this afternoon. Any other questions you would raise your hand and say, I want to ask something? We'll get one of our runners to you. We got two back here. Start you and then go to you, Bobby.
Yeah, so you mentioned not being afraid to fail, which I like totally agree with and I think is great. However, in ministry, it's always really scary to think about failure. You know, there's really bad consequences. So in the context of someone failing, what does recovery look like? What is recovering from that and getting back to successful?
The guy who said it was okay to fail, once you start with that one, I'm just kidding. I'll tell you this. We have so one of my responsibilities is church planter care. I've been doing that since 2020. Actually, my first day on the job leading national church planting care was the first day of COVID. I was supposed to be traveling to lead a conference, and instead I was online and figuring out how do we care for all these planters who are trying to make this happen, and now the world is shut down. And so throughout those years, what we try to do is we got to make sure any guy who's coming off the field, whether it's in the first 5 years or even beyond that, that feels like he's hit a hard wall and he's quote-unquote failing, is we have a lot of counseling services that we now relate to. We've vetted all of them. Sometimes they're longer retreats. Sometimes it's more of an intensive or an ongoing relationship. We want to make sure that they get into a gospel-centered counseling where they can reframe their worldview with what the Lord is doing in their life, calling, their identity in him, and all of those things. We don't want any guy ever falling into despair. Some guys just need a little bit of care, a little bit of relationship. Sometimes, like we see prophets in the Old Testament, they need something good to eat, and they need a nap, and they need some rest, and they come back. So I would start there with those guys. But what we try to do at Sun Network, and this is afforded by being a part of what I believe is the greatest family of churches, at least in North America, if not the planet, the SBC, is we care for our missionaries so extremely well. We have all these different angles for counseling services, not only for the planter, but his entire family, regular gifts of encouragement, opportunities to get them together with other people. What we would want to do is make sure they stayed in those relationships and had continual resourcing through that season of off-ramping.
So before you get to that point, what comes to mind is preparing to fail before you fail. And this may sound cliche. I know we're talking about a lot, just the gospel has to be in your bones that you have. So a friend of mine, Joe Rigney, is a good friend, and he's for years we worked together, and he talked about being sober-minded men. And what he meant by that was three things. You had clarity of mind, stability of soul, readiness to act. This clarity of mind, you've thought through issues, you walk into the room, you're prepared. The stability of soul piece was you know whose you are. Like you know. I know I'm, Jesus loves me. Jesus died for me. I'm a son of the Most High God. That's who I am. I can sit in this meeting, and if I don't have the answer, or I don't know what to say, or I get it wrong, my debt is paid. The record of debt that stood against me has been set aside, having been nailed to a tree. It's okay. It's okay. I think before you get there, and they're going to help press that into your bones, you've got to just settle that in your head. That I'm going to go do this thing in Northfield, Minnesota, or Boston, or wherever it is that God's going to call me, and I'm going to go, and I'm going to follow him, and if it doesn't work, I have a kingdom. You know, I failed at church planting, but I'm going to live on streets of gold, right? So I think you've just got to get that into your bones and be okay as the world falls apart, right? It's an enigma. It's like shepherding the wind. You can't get your head around this crazy world. You never will. You don't know why the church plant fails. You don't know why this was hard, but you know Jesus. You know Jesus, right? And he's enough. So I think you have to start there. And if that's not in your bones, then you're not ready.
That's primary for sure. And every failure story is different. But what I was just thinking about is it could be an issue of relocating. You know, you shake your sandals off and you move on. It's a biblical concept, right? That guy may go somewhere else and be very fruitful. You may reposition yourself, meaning you may go to another church and take a different position for a season to serve a local church in a different way, less pressure perhaps, different role, give you a season to heal up and just be faithful in that context, or to replant would be a third option. And we have a guy in our, one of our church planters is doing that very thing right now. Went for it for 4 years. A lot of it was kind of out of his control. A lot of his members relocated. Church went down to 11 people. He had it up to 40, 50, 60. And he's learned a lot in 4 years and some things he would like to do differently. And he's just like, it's kind of time to start all over again. Still wants to stay in the same area, but he's doing a replant. And we see that a lot too. So that would just be three. You know, options for that individual.
All three of those options start with re. That's how you know it's inspired. But I do like really start with the same letter too. I just love that stuff. So I think that's the most practical, just but like anecdotally, to hop on with Dr. Woodyard is that like I don't. Andy Wood is the pastor of Saddleback. Before that, he was a church planter of Echo. That's what he's known for. He also started a church in Dallas that didn't make it, that nobody knows about. I mean, it's a part of his testimony, so he's not ashamed to tell it. But I'm like, what does failure mean? Failure means that the gospel didn't take root through you in that neighborhood. And as long as I don't lose my marriage or my kids, God can call anybody to start a church in Boston. He's only called one man to eat at the table with Billy Jane, Garrett, Lauren, Ryan. There's only one place you're irreplaceable. That's your living room. So fail everywhere. Don't fail there.
We had a question here, yeah.
No, this is more of a broader SBC question, which you've mentioned about the planting healthy churches. And it seems like if you look at the convention, we love numbers. what do you do with the tension between planting healthy churches and the push within our convention for lots of churches? Does that make sense?
It makes a lot of sense. It is a tension we pray through and work for every single day. You know, one of the talking points the last couple of years has been churches plant churches. Denominations don't, networks don't. Even individuals don't. They have to have that spiritual covering, sending, preparing, training. Because what happens is, if a guy gets out there and he's not prepared, or we find out he has a theological squirrely thing that's off that nobody caught in any process, it often comes back to, hey, send network missed something. Well, we do a 2 to 3 day assessment that has pre-assessments, and guys can lie on that. It's much harder to lie if you're in a local church for 9 to 12 months plus, and you're looking that guy in the eye every day, and you're seeing theology work itself out. We need more churches to take that ownership of saying, we are planting churches. That's a part of that. And so two sides of that. We raise the bar of assessment to make sure that we are planting healthy churches with people who are prepared, and at the same time mobilizing as many churches as possible to say, we need you in this game. You know this because our work together over years past, but when my role started as the Send City missionary all the way back in 2011, I had two roles: mobilize planters, mobilize churches. There's even in our CRM system, there's two categories. It was contacts and accounts, and it was planters and it was churches. And over the years, we got focused in on really creating these systems to help the planter plant more healthy, coaching, training, assessment, orientation, care. And what we realized is that mobilization waned, and in this last season, we are pushing mobilization hard. Reproduce those sending churches. So a lot of our field staff, even the guys in the room now, they're doing a lot of things called sending labs and residency builders. These are events that are focused on the local church catching a vision for church planting, because the only way we're going to be able to thread that needle, plant healthy churches, which tends to slow things down and still hit the numbers that we believe God, you know, deserves, you know, as many churches as possible, we're going to need both of those things.
You've said planting healthy churches a lot, so I really appreciate the question. We want to see a lot of churches planted and can't wait for Kevin to get up and say we've planted, you know, a million churches or whatever. But so you keep saying healthy. Can you define it?
Yeah. So one of the ways we would say is healthy is the nine essentials. So we have a book that we're giving away. It's on the table out there.
Everybody grab it?
It's by Dr. Tony Morita. Everybody grab one of those. But it walks through these categories of what we believe a healthy planter needs to plant a healthy church. But we would talk about doctrine and theology being very, very robust. You know, one of the things, one of the questions that I don't know if we're going to get to here, but it's this question around what does it mean to be a big tent family? You guys may hear that language out in SBC. We're a big tent. Anytime we argue about something at the convention, but we're a big tent. Well, what does big tent mean, and how wide is that tent? Well, we are defined by the Baptist Faith and Message 2000. Like our entity, the North American Mission Board.
We're constrained.
We are constrained. We are trapped.
Happy within constrained.
And our hope... Our hope is that we would serve. We have an assignment. We actually have a number of assignments. You get on the NAM website, you can look this up. We have a number of assignments we are given by the convention to serve local churches in. And so we work with local churches, but we only plant and we only raise up and we only do all that we do according to the Baptist Faith and Message 2000. No other one out there. 2000 is the one that we are constrained by. And so there are local churches that may not fully adopt Baptist Faith and Message 2000, but when we plant their guy, he has got to agree to that. But I mentioned earlier, the struggle with autonomy is that the only authority we have over that local church is during the funding period. That's it. We train them up, we endorse them, and we fund them for 3 to 4 years. Beyond that, guys do whatever they want, just like any other local church does. You don't want the Baptist Pope coming in and telling your local church what they can and cannot do. But if we have a problem, what do? We go to convention, we send our messengers, we talk about it, we vote about it. And what we want to do is raise up our planters to be a fully operating member of that family of churches. But healthy for us is defined by Baptist Faith and Message 2000, biblical fidelity, but also the gospel urgency as well. I didn't grow up SBC, and when I was sold on the SBC, I was sold on the cooperative program. And I said, you mean to tell me thousands of churches give millions of dollars to plant churches all over the world? And the guy in my association said, in theory, yes. He said, if I want to plant thousands of churches all over the world, you will help me do that? Yes, here's our doctrine of theology. I love all of that. That's perfect. You're a body, a family of churches on the word and on the mission. Sign me up. What I found is not everybody is in the same place when it comes to the word or the mission. And if we all could be just be, you know, Imago Dei, that'd be good with me. I'd be great with that. But we're not. We're not all. So I think for us, does that answer that?
Yeah, I think I was getting to the healthy piece is, you know, you talked a minute ago, Tony, about how diverse you go to we are when you go to an assessment or you go to a convention, you see how diverse we are. We are diverse, but we're also constrained. We're diverse, and at the same time, we're like-minded because we're defined by the Baptist faith and message.
Yeah, we want to be very explicit about that. And there's nobody at Send Network that is trying to sneak in a closet Presbyterian or a closet Methodist or a non-denom. We actually, all the guys on this stage, we all serve with Send Network, and we actually have probably higher standards in the Baptist faith and message in many, many areas when it comes to what we think was doctrinal fidelity. And I think people in this room would be happy with that. But when it comes down to it, Baptist Faith and Message 2000, and we are called by the convention to serve all of our churches. We try to do that the best we can. You got time for one more? You got one more question? Okay.
What about BFN's call for members to absorb, see the two ordinances of Christ and observe those as members of a church while having tons of different services or multiple campuses where, like, preachers preach the same sermon, but not all the members of that church observe those things regularly or are accountable for each other, are going to testify on each other's behalf.
Are you talking about specifically baptism and the Lord's Supper and taking those as multiple
Can you
services?
Ask it a different way.
So are you looking at the BFNM and noticing the word observe, which is in the BFNM, and you're saying because it says observe the Lord's Supper, is that what you're keying on?
Yeah,
and you have to see it? You're taking the word observe to mean physical sight?
We'll take it, but then also that we'll give account for the people we covenant with.
Sure.
And as Baptists, we should be covenant members of a local church. But if you don't know those people, like, how do you do that well?
Yeah. That stops happening when your church gets above 150. So I grew up in a church that never got over 200. I'll say it's probably closer to 250. My wife grew up in a church that never got over 85. When our church got to be about 250 people, she said, "You know what I don't like about our church anymore?" I was offended by the question. I said, "What do you mean you don't like about our church? What are you talking about?" Because I saw it as my identity, right? So I said, "No, what?" And she goes, "I don't know everybody anymore." Like, so I don't, if you can, to know, for you, if you personally, as the only elder, have to know every person in your church, which, by the way, I don't think there's possible for the apostles at the day of Pentecost to know personally all of the thousands of people who were saved and baptized, but they had to know somebody, right? So everybody is known, everybody is accountable. I only have so much time in the day. I can maintain probably Jesus maintained 12 close friends, 3 great friends. And so if you and I think we're going to maintain great accountability with more than 12, you'd be a better leader than Jesus. Or you just need more help, right? So I think it's really important for every church, no matter the size, to raise up other people who are owning the responsibility of shepherding and pastoring with you, whether or not they hold the position or the title. But my response to my wife was, I said, "Babe, because at the time, there's only one English-speaking church that gives the gospel in Stoughton at the time, and they run 85, and our town has 31,000 people. So there's one other church of 85 in English." And I said, "Babe, if the goal is for everybody to know us, then what we're saying is that Grace Church will let 250 people come to know and follow Jesus, but everybody else in Stoughton goes to hell. It's not that they know us, it's that they know Jesus. And if I'm going to take my responsibility as a pastor well, from day one, as Tony said, I'm raising up other people, or better yet, to go out with other elders who are carrying that load from day one. So I think it's a good concern, but I think the shift is from the solo pastor who's doing everything to a team of men and women who are caring for men and women in the congregation.
I would think, listening to your question, you have a particular ecclesiological bent, right? And you and I are probably on the same side of things in certain ways. But I would say there's enough freedom in the way the Baptist faith and message is written that you can have Mark Dever in Capitol Hill Baptist Church, and you can have Jimmy Scroggins, and they can be friends and be in the same convention.
Yeah. Does that answer your question? Yeah, no. I think one of the answers, too, that we it's not just resourcing a guy through assessment with new churches that Tony talked about earlier. We are hoping to resource them on all kinds of things, including ecclesiology. One of the things that I noticed growing up is church membership was not a thing people talked about a whole lot. Or you could show up. It happened in my church I'm at right now. I'm not an elder yet, but I had a gal that's like doesn't want to go through the membership process. She's like, I just want to move my letter from my last church. I'm like, I don't see that in Scripture. We're different than that church. So why don't you go through our class to know our doctrine, and so we can get to know you personally so you can actually be a member. And so I think raising the bar on ecclesiology, specifically church membership, allows us to actually have a covenant so that church discipline can take place. But I think that's one of the things we want to see in this generation is continue to raise the bar on all the things the Bible puts in front of us as important, and we'll get there together.